From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins in for Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And there might be a light at the end of this very long political tunnel. New York's Cardinal Timothy Dolan says Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton had some nice things to say to each other offstage at that Al Smith charity roast last night, just 24 hours after that sizzling debate at which they refused to shake hands. But last night's dinner also veered into more insults than the self-roasting humor it's known for. And this morning, Cardinal Dolan told NBC's Today Show there were touching moments between the candidates.
When we were going in, I said, could we pray together as we were waiting to be announced? And after the little prayer, Mr. Trump turned to Secretary Clinton and said, you know, you are one tough and talented woman. And he said, this has been a good experience in this whole campaign, as tough as it's been. And she said to him, and Donald, whatever happens, we need to work together afterwards.
Is that angel singing? I believe it is.
Here and Now,
2016.
Joining us for our weekly roundup of the campaign, Enrique Acevedo, news anchor at Univision. He joins us from Miami. Hey, Enrique.
Hi, Lisa.
And also John Ralston, political commentator in Nevada. He joins us from Las Vegas right now. Hello, John.
Hi there.
Okay, let's start up with a quick assessment now. A little more than 2 weeks to go before Election Day. Where are we now in the campaign? Who wants to go for it? Neither one of you wants to go. Robin will answer it.
I'll jump in if you want me to.
Go, John.
Listen, the campaign is slowly slipping away from Donald Trump, not just here in Nevada, but nationally. And I think despite the fact that the Al Smith dinner is supposed to be, as you pointed out, full of self-deprecating humor, Trump couldn't help but lapse into not only just his stump speech, but some borderline nasty kinds of things. And I admire the Cardinal, a religious man, for being able to credit both of those candidates with being able to be phony with him for a total of about 6 seconds.
Okay, that's your take on it, and others are probably agreeing that, you know, that's not the tenor of the campaign. But Enrique, let's talk about last night. As John said, Donald Trump, he actually got one of the rare boos at one of these dinners for veering into the leaked emails that revealed Clinton sometimes took public positions different from private ones, and showed her Catholic aides sometimes insulted Catholics.
Hillary believes that it's vital to deceive the people by having one public policy and a totally different policy in private. That's okay. I don't know who they're angry at, Hillary. You're right. For example, here she is tonight in public, pretending not to hate Catholics.
Okay, another boo. Well, the Daily Beast reports today that Donald Trump's father was arrested in 1927 at a KKK rally in Queens, which was part of an anti-Catholic protest of the then New York Governor Al Smith, who became this first Catholic nominee for president, hence the dinner in his honor. But I just want, Clinton also got jeered a little, so let's just listen. She took a shot at Trump's unwillingness to accept the election results.
You know, come to think of it, it's amazing I'm up here after Donald. I didn't think he'd be okay with a peaceful transition of power. And Donald, after listening to your speech, I will also enjoy listening to Mike Pence deny that you ever gave it.
Okay, so Enrique, weigh in. I mean, do you think it's possible that there will be a gentle landing on Election Day and that Clinton and Trump might work together and that Trump supporters or even Sanders supporters might, you know, be singing Kumbaya?
Well, Robin, first of all, neither candidate is known for their comedic skills, so we have to at least give them that. I think it's going to depend on the result of the election. If it's a tight, very close race, then the rationale behind Trump's movement will gain some momentum. And that's unfortunate because, like Hillary Clinton said, they have to work together. On November 9th, no matter who wins, they inherit a divided country. It's fair to say this is not your typical election. So it's not politics as usual. The level of division and polarization in the country should worry everyone, and everyone should be doing their best to achieve this goal of working together on November 9th.
Meanwhile, Donald Trump has said once again that he will totally accept the results of this great and historical presidential election if he is the winner. Last night, it was reported that his national political director has decided to take a step back from the campaign. What is Trump trying to achieve in terms of his own staffing?
Well, listen, people have been coming and going from the Trump campaign for a long time. He's gone through these convulsions frequently during the campaign. Well, what's become clear is that the only consistent campaign manager for Donald Trump is Donald Trump. He believes in his own counsel above all others. And while there have been spurts during the campaign when he has been disciplined, they have not lasted very long, whether it's for 20 minutes or so during a debate or for a few days during the campaign. And I think that's been very, very frustrating for Republicans who either want to support him or can't support Hillary Clinton, that they believe that if he had just done X instead of Y, that maybe he would be closer now, maybe even he would be ahead. So it's not surprising that people close to him in the campaign keep stepping back. That was the term used for the national political director. I think maybe a more unkind way to describe it would be just another rat getting off of a sinking ship.
And you can see that. I mean, I agree with John. You can see that in the contradictions that explain not only the debate, but also Trump's campaign. He says he loves Hispanics, but then calls undocumented immigrants bad hombres.
Well,
he says he loves women and then calls Hillary Clinton a nasty woman. He says he's for law and order, but then talks about shooting people on Fifth Avenue. So there's a campaign, and then there's what the candidate wants to do.
Well, and some people are speculating that what is happening right now with the polls showing that his campaign is slipping is that he's building his proposed television network, and that the Democrats on the other side, I mean, you have Steve Schmidt, the Republican, he's a Trump critic, but he's a Republican strategist. He says the campaign is over. So that's leading to the speculation that he's looking beyond that. Whereas the Democrats are also looking beyond the election and trying to see his, you know, how many House and Senate seats they can get, sending out heavy hitters like First Lady Michelle Obama. Let's listen to a little.
He demeans and humiliates women as if we're objects meant solely for pleasure and entertainment rather than human beings worthy of love and respect. He just doesn't understand us.
Is this, you know, some people have said this could be the Clinton campaign worried. Is it rather, though, Enrique, maybe the Clinton campaign thinking, how far can we go?
I think at this point, it's all about the turnout. You look at the polls, and they do suggest that the race might be over. But just 2 weeks ago, I was in Colombia for the peace referendum. All the polls indicated that the yes vote was going to win by a big margin. And the no vote ended up winning. So why that happened has to do with a very low turnout, a historically low turnout. So if you see, if you look at both campaigns, right now, they're both working on getting people out to vote. On the Democratic side, we saw President Barack Obama yesterday in Florida say that the only way that they were going to lose the campaign, they were going to lose the election, is that if people didn't turn out to vote. And on the other side, you have the Republicans and Donald Trump. In a way, their strategy right now is, it feels like they're trying to,
depress the vote?
Depress, exactly. So so people don't really turn out to vote, and maybe that's a way that they can get a few states.
Uh-huh.
Yesterday, there was another WikiLeaks leak that revealed that there is dissent in the campaign, the Clinton campaign, over the Clinton Foundation event in Morocco that was funded with large donations from foreign governments. The close aide to Hillary Clinton wrote of Clinton, the candidate, "She created this mess and she knows it." Has anything from these leaked emails from WikiLeaks stuck to the Clinton campaign, John?
Well, it should have stuck. A lot more of it should have stuck, I think, Lisa. The problem is while there's some very, very damaging things in the WikiLeaks, for instance, during the debate, Chris Wallace brought up the open borders comment from Hillary Clinton. But she is so skillful at not talking about what she doesn't want to talk about. She pivoted to Russia immediately, blaming Russia for the WikiLeaks hack, and essentially said that Donald Trump is a puppet of Putin. Putin, which totally changed the dialogue. She has been able to get off of what I think are some really, really damaging revelations in the WikiLeaks documents that would have damaged any other candidate. The problem for Donald Trump is that these kinds of things have happened before, and he lets it. He is okay for a couple of days. He's able to stay on message, but then he somehow reflects all the attention back on himself with some kind of gaffe, some kind of statement that takes the focus off of WikiLeaks. If this were a normal campaign, this would have really damaged Hillary Clinton and should have probably. But this is not, I think we can all agree, a normal campaign.
I think
Lisa, absolutely.
Can.
And I was going to say also the timing of the WikiLeaks revelations are especially important, because I think if this had happened during the primaries, Hillary Clinton would have lost the nomination.
Oh, really?
Well,
she couldn't have withstood that.
The transcripts of the speeches that Bernie Sanders insisted on being released, some of the proposals that contradict what Hillary Clinton said at some point during the primaries,
it could have been much damaging
during that time.
Enrique Acevedo, news anchor at Univision, and John Ralston, political commentator in Nevada, with a couple weeks and a few days till elections. Thank you, and we'll see you again.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And this week's political news sent social media into a frenzy. All the nasty hashtags after Trump called Clinton just that, and the Trump hashtag drain the swamp. Julia Turner is editor-in-chief of Slate. She's in New York. Julia, hi.
Hello.
And I bet this has been a spigot for you this week. So let's start with the nasty woman reference. Here's that moment in the debate.
My Social Security payroll contribution will go up, as will Donald's, assuming he can't figure out how to get out of it. But what we want to do is to replenish the Social Security Trust Fund by making
sure... Okay, such a nasty woman. What happened online?
The dynamic of the final debate was that Hillary Clinton found a more aggressive register. She was needling Trump throughout the debate. She described his performance in his meeting in Mexico as choking. And she successfully goaded him into lashing out at her in a way that wasn't particularly becoming for him. And folks online really seized upon this nasty woman reference as a proud way to refer to Hillary Clinton. You saw young women and women of all ages all over the internet professing to be nasty women. You saw people starting to peddle nasty woman shirts and pins and gear on the internet. Someone made a website called Nasty Women Get a Euphemism for Stuff Done that redirected to Hillary Clinton's campaign website. So it really took fire.
Yeah. I'm with Nasty Woman was another hashtag. And then shortly after, there was the mashup of Janet Jackson's 1986 song Nasty with Trump's debate comments. Let's listen.
Nasty. Nasty woman.
So by 9 o'clock the next day, streams of Nasty were up 250% on Spotify. You know, it's just taken off like wildfire. Look, Donald Trump has tried to create his own social media moment. He unveiled a plan to end corruption in Washington and started using the phrase, drain the swamp. Let's listen.
It is time to drain the swamp in Washington, D.C. This is why I'm proposing a package of ethics reforms to make our government honest once again.
Julia, what's happened with that hashtag?
Yeah, so I think that's the Trump campaign attempting something that the Clinton campaign did in the first couple debates. You saw it at the end of the first debate where she kind of weaseled this story about Trump's mistreatment of Alicia Machado, the former Miss Universe who gained weight, into an answer about something entirely different. And, you know, immediately the Clinton campaign came out with a well-produced ad, and there were stories about Machado that came out in other media outlets. And I think we're seeing something with Drain the Swamp and a proposed package of ethics reforms that's an effort to gain traction in the right-wing media sphere. And you do see, if you follow the Drain the Swamp hashtag on Twitter, you will get a clear sense of how Trump supporters are viewing the election. There's a lot of interest in the Podesta emails. There's a lot of interest in corruption against Hillary. And it's a useful way to get that lens on how his supporters are viewing things at this point.
Right. But it all goes to this awareness of the campaigns. And there was another moment in the debate in which social media figured in another way. Let's listen.
Back in the 1970s, I worked for the Children's Defense Fund, and I was taking on discrimination against African-American kids in schools. he was getting sued by the Justice Department for racial discrimination in his apartment buildings.
And Julia Turner, on it went, you know, noting that he was on The Apprentice when she was doing something else. And you tell us that this line was actually workshopped online.
Yeah, I mean, I think what we're seeing there is a very interesting evolution of the dynamic of trying to come up with a few stories that will play well, or a few moments or lines that will play well on social media the following day. You know, in early October, the Clinton campaign launched an interactive tool online and on mobile called Shuffle, I think. And what it asked you to do was sort of hit a shuffle button, and you would see a bunch of rotating pictures of Clinton and Trump from various points in their lives. And then it would pop up a year, and it would describe to you what Hillary Clinton had been doing in that year and what Donald Trump had been doing in that year. And, of course, in terms very favorable to Clinton, talking about her, you know, work for women and children and her, you know, commitment to public service. And that piece did go viral. It was very usable on phones. It was really well designed to surf the currents of social media as they exist today. Mm. But it was really interesting to see, rather than the candidate floating something at the debate that they hoped would gain traction online the following day, them actually floating something online, finding that it was such a viral success that she really found a way to shoehorn that comparative experience list into the debate. And that was, I think, a successful moment for her.
Yeah. I just want to ask you just a closing thought here about the negative aspects of social media. They always surface. The Anti-Defamation League put out a report this week on a big increase in anti-Semitic tweets during the campaign season, many directed at journalists. And then BuzzFeed just did an analysis on political posts from six big hyperpartisan sites left and right, and found that the least accurate pages generated the highest shares, far more than the three large mainstream political news pages. And right-wing pages had the inaccuracies 38% of the time, left-wing pages 20% of the time. Brian Stelter, the media critic, says this might be one of the most important media stories of the year. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think it's very important to understand this kind of sub-news ecosystem. And I think very impressive work has been done by The Wall Street Journal, by The New York Times, and by BuzzFeed. And I think a few other outlets are starting to look at this to really understand where are people getting their news. A lot of it is pretty far removed from traditional outlets, and social media does aid and abet that. On the other hand, I think extreme partisan media making outlandish claims on behalf of the ideologies they represent is something that's been part of the American media ecosystem for decades. It's taking a different form now, and I think it's important to understand and follow that form, but I don't think we really fully understand all the dynamics at play.
Yeah. Julia Turner, editor-in-chief of Slate. Julia, thank you as always.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, yes, there is a presidential election, but in Milwaukee, middle schoolers at St. Anthony School have been focusing on their own campaigns in the race for student council. Is there anything more important at that age? And school administrators and teachers in Milwaukee are encouraging students to not follow the example of adults. Rachel Morello of Here and Now contributor WUWM reports.
It's a Monday after school. 20 kids running for St. Anthony Student Council are gathered in a classroom to work on their campaigns. Some are clacking away on laptops, preparing speeches.
If you need help with something, I can help you always. And if you think we should do something, go ahead, tell me what you want to do. For boys, you can play soccer outside, and for girls, you can put a little bit of lipstick, not a lot.
Others have gathered art supplies and big sheets of white paper to make campaign posters.
I'm going to use some markers and some crayons and probably some glue so I can put on glitter.
Despite the obvious parallel, any mention of the national election is noticeably absent during this workshop. Teacher and student council advisor Haley Shaw says that's because last year, a few kids modeled their campaigns after what they saw nationally.
They would just put posters of Hillary and Trump and, you know, big red X's and which one they didn't like and, you know, vote for me because I'm not like this person or something. And we just decided this year that we were going to kind of leave that behind and have them focus on themselves more so than the presidential candidates.
Yet Shaw says she and her colleagues have held a few conversations with the kids about tone and tactics. For instance, teacher Gretchen Zydek made this announcement.
Now, I don't think anyone in this room would do this, but we just need to make sure that it's out there. By running for an elected position, you will not bully, you will not bribe others, meaning...
And it's clear, students are taking the lessons to heart.
Oh, remember, hashtag Fernando for president, it's a trend.
Where is it a trend?
Instagram. I'm just kidding. We're not allowed to use social media.
I was going to say, I thought I heard a rumor.
This is fifth grader Fernanda Munoz. In a word, Fernanda is confident. She served as student council vice president last year. This time, she's going for the top spot. But she faces a unique challenge, running against her best friend, Chantel. The two girls say they'll be happy whoever wins. In fact, they're glad they can work with each other, even if that means just sitting next to each other, offering advice on the other's poster.
Because then you get to share your opinions, which makes it a lot easier for you, and help them out. And they help you out, too, in return.
Can we practice ours?
Yeah, we start practicing right now.
After just 1 week of tweaking their speeches, it's finally here, Election Day. The candidates are backstage in the school gym / auditorium, getting ready to speak in front of the entire student body.
Give me one word to describe how you feel. Go.
Nervous. Amazing.
Nervous.
Nervous. Butterflies in my stomach.
Despite their nerves, it's clear the students have absorbed the tone teachers have been encouraging. The kids cheer and clap as each returns backstage after giving his or her speech.
From grade to the age and effort, I know I'm right for the job. I have the grit and courage to be your president.
This is what St. Anthony School President Jose Vasquez says he wants students to take away from the experience of running for office.
All of this is very important because what we're showing and instructing the children is they've got to take leadership roles. They've got to be involved in their community. In this stage, it's the community of their school. Is eventually we want them to become leaders involved in their greater community, the city of Milwaukee, the county of Milwaukee. So for us, it starts very young. But it's
with the votes tallied, 10-year-old Fernanda Munoz will now get her first chance to be a leader. She won her bid for student council president. Fernanda and the other members elected to student council will lead pep rallies and bake sales and speak on behalf of their peers in conversations with adults in the school, including the principal. For Here and Now, I'm Rachel Morello in Milwaukee.
AT&T is in talks to acquire Time Warner, according to a report from today's Wall Street Journal. The deal is pretty far along. It could happen as early as this weekend, and if it does, it would merge AT&T's wireless and TV services with Time Warner's treasured trove of networks, including CNN, HBO, and Warner Brothers. It would be the biggest media telecom merger since Comcast bought NBC Universal 5 years ago. Mike Regan is a columnist for Bloomberg Gadfly. Mike, AT&T is pursuing Time Warner. What does AT&T want from the deal aside from the chance to get even bigger?
Well, AT&T CEO Randall Stephenson has basically been looking to transform and expand the phone company into a more diversified company. And media and entertainment is seen as sort of a natural fit, not just for AT&T, but for other big companies. And Bloomberg is reporting that this deal is sort of being rushed because AT&T is hoping to get it done by Monday because there's a concern that other big buyers like Alphabet, which is the parent of Google, or Apple could even jump in and snatch up Time Warner. So they're hoping to get this deal done soon.
AT&T, and that is really soon, AT&T bought DirecTV last year. It's reportedly planning to launch a video service this year, something akin to Hulu and Netflix. Could you, though, put this in an even broader context, how common it is for a company like AT&T offering wireless and broadband and phone services to merge with a media company? You said it's kind of a natural thing. Why?
Well, I think there's a lot of business sense to combine the companies that produce video and other digital content with those that actually distribute it, like AT&T.
But they're kind of two different things.
They are, but there is, you know, sort of this natural fit that if you're going to be distributing content, you might as well be profiting from actually creating it, too. And as you pointed out, you know, the Comcast for NBC Universal was a very similar idea. And AT&T's biggest rival, Verizon, has recently bought AOL and the Huffington Post and Yahoo, all for sort of the same reasons, to get the content creation and the distribution businesses all under one roof.
It has to go through regulators, of course. Regulators killed AT&T's bid to buy T-Mobile 5 years ago. What are they going to be looking at this time around when they make their decision?
Yeah, well, obviously AT&T would have a hard time buying another big phone company, as it found out with T-Mobile, because of the monopoly concerns. But this type of deal actually allows them to expand vastly without really creating a monopoly in any one single line of business. But that said, I'm sure regulators will take a look at it from every possible angle to figure out what ramifications there are and if there is any reason to put up a block for it.
And, of course, cost to the consumers is an issue. Mergers mean less competition. That usually means higher prices. What would a potential merger mean for the consumer?
Well, it brings up a lot of intriguing possibility. AT&T owns DirecTV, so it does make you wonder if they could possibly try to bundle Time Warner's TV and movie content into the DirecTV package to make it more attractive to consumers, much like it did with the NFL. So it'll be interesting to see what their strategy really is going forward now that they have this sort of diverse set of businesses all under one roof.
Well, it sounds like we're going to find out pretty soon then.
We'll see. Check back on Monday.
Mike Regan, columnist for Bloomberg Gadfly. Nice to speak with you, Mike.
You too, Lisa. Thank you.
Winnie the Pooh, Winnie the Pooh, chubby little cubby all stuffed with fluff. He's Winnie the Pooh,
Winnie the Pooh,
willy nilly silly old bear.
90 years ago this month, A.A. Milne published Winnie the Pooh, and readers swooned over the stories of the bear and his bestie, Christopher Robin. Since then, Winnie has appeared in TV shows, films, books, including four new adventures featuring Winnie and a new pal, a penguin. But once he was a she and a real-life bear, beloved by a Canadian veterinarian who was on his way to treat horses on the European battlefields of World War I when he bought the bear cub on a train platform in White River, Ontario, and named her Winnie. Then she was loved by everyone at the London Zoo, where she took up residence and was visited by a little boy named Christopher. The real Winnie is the subject of statues in London and Winnipeg. Her story is told in the picture book Finding Winnie, The Story of the Bear Who Inspired Winnie the Pooh, by Canadian author Lindsay Maddock, who happens to be the great-granddaughter of that Canadian veterinarian, Captain Harry Colburn, who started it all. We spoke with Lindsay last November and asked, did she constantly hear this story growing up?
I did hear this story. It's funny because there was a certain humility about it, and it wasn't well known until there was an article in a Canadian newspaper back in the late 80s that said that the bear belonged to a different regiment. And my grandfather, Fred, said, no, that was actually my dad's bear, and her name was Winnipeg, Winnie for short, after the Canadian city of Winnipeg, and set about correcting the story, and then it became really well known in Canada.
Your cover was blown. Yes,
exactly.
You are the descendants of the man who found him. Now, the story that you tell in this beautifully illustrated book, illustrated by Sophie Blackall, it has a mother telling this story to her child. We find out later that it's you, your child. The illustrations take up full pages, but somewhere in the bottom corner of every page is a pencil sketch of you and your son hearing this story. Did that really happen? Did you really tell him this story?
No, I didn't, actually.
Oh, that would have been such a good story.
Cole, my son, is not only is the book for him, I dedicated it to him, but it's really also because of him. At some point, I knew I was going to have a child, and I thought there was no better way to explain them this amazing family story than to do it as a picture book. And so when I found out I was pregnant a few years ago, I basically had this 9-month kind of deadline to take my first crack at writing a picture book.
Well, and you tell the story beautifully. The train rolls through dinner and over the sunset and around 10 o'clock and into a nap and out the next day until it stops at White River. And as you remember the story told by your great-grandfather, he gets off the train and what?
He got off the train. He was a veterinarian, so he loved animals. He grew up around animals. And there was a trapper, and he had killed a bear, and he was selling this cub for $20, which was a lot of money back in 1914, about almost $500 today. And I think he realized that this little bear wouldn't have much of a fate in front of her, so he... I think with a bit of a sense of optimism, nobody knew how long and what the First World War would entail, but I think he thought she would be a source of joy for him and his fellow soldiers. And he made this sort of audacious move by buying her and getting back on the train and then getting on a ship across the Atlantic to the Salisbury Plain, which is where the Canadian soldiers trained. The army camps were there. And they lived there together for about 4 months. And it was a brutal fall. It was very rainy and very cold. But 4 months later, they had to go to the front lines in France. And he knew it was not going to be safe for a little bear cub. And he drove her in a car from the Salisbury Plain to London, to the London Zoo, and said, "Will you look after my pet bear for a little while?" And they said yes.
Kind of heartbreaking scene. I want to go back a little bit. And we know this is all true and not some fantastic story that your great-grandfather told, because there are pictures. And there is Winnie the Pooh at her post, and there's a little post that she's climbing on, the real Winnie with the soldiers looking at her. Here's Winnie and Harry, your great-grandfather, having what appears to be a snack. This is all when they're training. There's a full picture of his regiment with their little tiny bear sitting in Harry's lap. And what I love is that, you know, you have drawings in your illustrated children's book of Winnie standing at attention. But he did. I mean, he did. Look at him right there. His legs are straight down. He's not bent over at all.
It all happened. And it's amazing to have the photographs because the photographs remind me that it's true. And one of the other pieces in our family archive that had that kind of amazing impact on me was his diaries. He kept diaries throughout all the years of the war, and they're very sparse in what they say, but he made notations of things that went on. So there's this notation, August 24th, 1914, bought bear, $20. And, you know, he had no idea 100 years ago that this simple act, he stops, he buys a bear, gets back on the train. And years later, it would inspire children's stories that are so beloved.
Well, it's a story that unfolds in two acts. So let us go on to act two. Harry has left this little bear, kind of heartbreaking scene, at the zoo. But then a little boy comes to the zoo and falls in love with Winnie. And who is that boy?
Christopher Robin.
Get out of town. Like, this is all real. And what I really couldn't believe is that Christopher Robin is allowed to go down and play with the bear.
That is one of the most amazing things about this story, is the fact that in 1914, apparently, they let children go into enclosures that had bears on them. Winnie was well known. She was written about by zookeepers saying she was the only bear they trusted entirely because she had such a friendly nature. Children would ride on her back. She would do tricks for them. So she was a real favorite at the London Zoo.
Well, and we know this is possible with bears because we've seen circus bears, that bears, you know, are trained and can be befriended. And here again is proof. There's a picture. This is in 1925 of Christopher Robin and a very big Winnie. Winnie's grown, just together at the zoo. And Christopher Robin all alone down in the enclosure. There's no adults down there. It's amazing.
It is amazing. You think about, you know, in 2015, I think that's pretty unheard of.
Yeah. But, of course, Christopher Robin's father was
A.A. Milne. And he saw his little boy befriending a bear. And his son, Christopher Robin, had a stuffed bear. And he had never quite found the right name for him. He'd had several names, Edward, Big Bear. But when he met Winnie, he renamed his stuffed bear Winnie after this real bear at the London Zoo. And A.A. Milne took inspiration from her name and named his central character Winnie the Pooh.
Do we know where the Pooh comes from?
Yes. Christopher Robin also had a little friend that was a swan, and the swan would shed its feathers. And when the feathers would land on his sleeve, he would need to get them off by blowing them, and he would make the sound pooh, pooh. So apparently that's where the Pooh part comes from.
Oh, it's so unbelievable, and yet true. And something that at the end of the book you can tell your child, because it also is why you named him.
That's right. Because this story has inspired me ever since I was a kid, I really wanted to keep this story close to my son. So when I found out I was having a boy, I thought I could call him Colburn.
After Captain Harry Colburn, the man who bought the bear, yep.
So my dedication to my son, Cole, is that may this story always remind you of the impact one small loving gesture can have. I really wanted him to keep that inspiration close to him, that you just never know. And my great-grandfather had no idea that over 100 years ago, he would have this very simple moment buying a bear cub. And so many years later, a century later, people around the world would still be reading and loving stories about a character that was inspired by her.
Yeah. I almost don't want to ask, but did whatever happened to Winnie, the real Winnie?
So Winnie lived for 20 years, which apparently is a long time for a bear. She had a good life, 20 years at the zoo. Harry planned to take her home. He had written on the back of a photograph that he would be bringing her home someday to Canada with him. But I think the war went on longer than anyone would have expected, and he realized she had a new home.
And had a wonderful life there. Well, Lindsay Maddock, don't blame us if Cole comes home with baby bears.
That is something Cole would do.
Lindsay Maddock is author of the new children's picture book, Finding Winnie, the true story of the world's most famous bear, who was found by her great-grandfather over 100 years ago. Lindsay, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me on.
You could only hear the birds this morning for a moment in Wales today as people fell silent to mark the 50th anniversary of a disastrous day. On October 21st, 1966, a Friday morning, the tip of a mountain of coal waste became loose and an avalanche of thousands of tons of liquefied black slurry buried homes and a school in a Welsh village known as Aberfan. 144 people were killed, 116 of them were children. Jeremy Bowen is the BBC's Middle East editor. He has a personal connection to the story. He joins us now from London. Hello, Jeremy.
Hi.
I wonder if you would first set the scene for us. What happened that morning?
The centre of Aberfan, including the school for under-11s, was swamped by a huge tide of slurry coming from a coal tip. It's a coal mining area, was then anyway. And this tip loomed over the village, and there was a spring underneath it, a spring of water, and it dislodged after a lot of heavy rain, and then a massive slide came in and swamped a lot of the village and particularly the school.
A lot of reporters came to the scene. One of them was your father, who was a journalist for the BBC, Gareth Bowen. He worked for the BBC, went to the scene of the disaster as crews were digging into the rubble to try to free anybody who had survived. We're going to ask you, Jeremy, now if you would listen to his report along with us.
Sure.
I'm now looking through the walls of the shattered school into the main hall, which is a mass of people and firemen and policemen. Mothers, fathers, brothers and sisters and everybody. And standing once again on a pile of black slurry. And underneath us is the infant school. And the debris is going away, handful by handful, brick by brick. The men are standing up to their knees in black water.
Sandwiches, something to eat.
Where are you from?
Tree Forest.
Salvation Army?
Yes.
How long have you been here, sir?
11:15 this morning.
It's about 12 hours.
Yeah.
Why are you digging?
My niece is under there.
Anybody want a sandwich?
Within a 50-yard radius of where I'm standing on this jagged, unexpected hill, lit by portable floodlights and light from miners wearing helmets, are working, I should say, about 450 people, men, women, and boys. They don't know where they're digging. All they know is that they've got to dig. Is there anybody you know under this wreckage?
Yes, my best friend is, well, within 5 yards of us now. I went down earlier on to look at him. They're trying to get him out now, but of course all this stuff is still falling in on the people who are trying to work. And they've got to protect the living, of course, and it's very dangerous for all the men who are working down there.
Tonight, here you can see all sorts and conditions of men from the Merthyr Borough. Working down there with a pneumatic drill is Eddie Thomas, the famous boxing champion, and now Howard Winston's manager. He's been working there for 8 hours and he hasn't stopped. With a spade, he takes a shovel, and then he takes a pneumatic drill. And always he's working, and never has he been in such a tough fight. All over Wales, men have been finishing work and coming straight down to Aberfan. Now, you, sir, where have you come from?
I've come from Llanfaslin in Montgomeryshire.
Why did you come? Have you any relations here?
I've got no relations here. I just felt it my duty to come.
And what have you been doing since you arrived?
Well, I've been digging and moving this earth as much as I can.
Do you think it's a hopeless task?
Well, nothing's hopeless. You can't expect it to be hopeless. People, they've got faith. People believe there's some relatives of theirs alive still.
Have you got faith?
Yes, I have. I wouldn't have come down here tonight if I didn't have some.
Once again, that's a report from former BBC journalist Gareth Bowen, who 50 years ago today was at the scene in Aberfan, Wales, as rescuers dug for survivors who'd been buried by coal ash. 5 children survived. We're speaking with Bowen's son, Jeremy Bowen, who also works for the BBC. Jeremy, When you hear the report, I wonder if you can just tell us professionally and personally what it means to you.
Well, professionally, I think it was a great piece of reporting. On a personal level, it's extremely poignant, particularly on this anniversary, because it's hard for me to talk about it. My father's dying at the moment. He's in the terminal phases of dementia. I wish he could hear this today. He'd be so proud. Excuse me.
I'm so sorry.
He'd be very proud. He'd be very proud for his reporting to be broadcast across America.
Absolutely. And it was a brilliant piece of reporting.
It's funny. I've never been like this on air in my whole life. And I've been to, you know, I've been to 20 wars. But, you know, this is a personal thing.
We wish your dad the best and your family. And it's a good legacy that he's leaving. We appreciate it. And thank you, Jeremy Bowen, BBC's Middle East editor, Jeremy Bowen, speaking about what his father reported on 50 years ago today. And we should say also that there were new regulations passed after that, safety regulations, as a result of the event in Wales. Jeremy, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
And Lisa, his father's reporting, how elegant. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.